May it please the court, my name is David Schoberg. I represent the appellant, Glenn Johnson, in this matter. Your Honors, we're here on an appeal based upon the court's, district court's decision to deny or refuse the appellant's request or motion to withdraw his guilty plea. I think there's some substantial and compelling reasons why that motion should have been granted. First and foremost, this motion to withdraw the guilty plea was brought both under Rule 15.05, Subdivision 1, which addresses the manifest injustice, and under 15.05, Subdivision 2, which is the fair and just provisions. In this particular case, I think it's first and foremost, it's important to note that the guilty plea was not accepted in this case.
Why does that make a difference?
I mean, 1505. I think we're instructed we don't accept guilty pleas until the time of sentencing. That's the way I did it for 18 and a half years as a district court judge. So I agree with the question. Why is that significant here?
15.052 subdivision, Rule 1505, Subdivision 2, specifically refers to this motion being brought, if I can review it, prior to or after the conviction and before sentencing. In this particular case, you're right, it is a common practice for judges to refuse or to not accept or defer acceptance of it. I believe under those circumstances, Your Honor, there's even an additional cause for the district court to grant a defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. Having said that, I also acknowledge that an appellant, or in this particular case, or any defendant, does not have the absolute right to withdraw his guilty plea, but that the district court must be very lenient in giving due consideration to those causes as set forth in State versus Williams. In this particular case, the appellant provided several different grounds under which the court could have considered it fair and just to allow him to withdraw his guilty plea. If I can address those in order. Specifically, he argued that there was undue pressure by his counsel to accept this guilty plea. The second was his...
No, that does seem to be contradicted by the plea transcript, right? By the questions of the judge on that.
Yes and no, Your Honor. So specifically, there's this undue pressure of his counsel, but when we take that in context of his significant cognitive limitations that are acknowledged throughout the whole transcript, I think those go hand in hand.
But is there any expert testimony in the record that his cognitive impairments would have impacted his ability to understand what was happening, especially in light of his prior criminal experience, understand what was happening and make a knowing, intelligent, voluntary decision to plead guilty and to accept a plea agreement?
The short answer to your question is no, Your Honor.
Okay.
There is no expert.
Where does that leave us in terms of deciding whether the district court abused its discretion and not allowing plea withdrawal for that reason?
Sure. So we go into his cognitive deficiencies, which is one of the big compelling reasons that I think the district court should have considered more thoroughly. First, we examine the different sources that set forth his cognitive disabilities. First and foremost, the defendant describes in his affidavit that he submitted some of his deficiencies. That's probably the least conclusive of the sources.
Right. I mean, and there's nothing in the affidavit that says, well, or there's no evidence from an expert saying because of those deficits. I mean, he's held a job. He's lived in the world. He's been through the criminal process on a prior occasion without having a Rule 20 designation or anything like that. I mean, there was no record evidence that those impairments would have prevented him from knowing what he was doing.
But it would make it less likely that he would have known what he was doing. So we look at the psychologist, Fran Starts, who indicates that he acknowledges cognitive ability may be better suited to participate in a treatment program geared to those with cognitive disabilities. His treating therapist, Dr. Jennifer Lees, indicates that his thoughts tend to be more adolescence. And even the state in their arguments, Ms. Verdeja, acknowledges that this is an individual that has some impairments. So while we don't have any specific expert testimony saying, hey, he did not comprehend it, We certainly have very compelling evidence to suggest that he would have had a limited capacity to understand these proceedings as he was moving forward through them.
In reviewing this matter, and I'll let you finish your argument on the other matters, I think this is a pretty brief question, but is the fact that he waited 5 months as opposed to bringing his motion, say, the next week or 2 weeks, where does that fit into the district court judges and our consideration as to whether or not there was an abuse of discretion?
Sure.
Because it seems like all of these things, you know, I mean, I think it can be argued this could be second thoughts as opposed to these other issues that you're raising here. And if it is something more than second thoughts, he would have raised it sooner. How do we address that?
You know, I believe there's actually case law to suggest that that is one of the factors the court should consider, the length of time in the overall analysis that the court would put forth. This wasn't argued by either Mr. Haig or Ms. Verdeja at the district court level, but I think in my review of the case law, it is certainly a factor that the courts at the appellate level or at the district level should and can consider. Mm-hmm. It doesn't appear that this was necessarily a basis for Judge Sullivan's decision, but it certainly could have been a basis or a factor that he could have considered.
Thank you.
Yes. So when we're balancing, so we have these cognitive disabilities combined with his assertions of pressure by his prior counsel. And we go down to the third factor, which is profession of innocence, which is also a compelling factor. Now, I acknowledged in my brief that that in and of itself probably should never be a great basis to withdraw a guilty plea. But when you have a combination of his assertion of innocence, his limited cognitive abilities, and his assertion that he was being pressured, overly pressured by his prior counsel, we certainly have a basis for fair and equitable that his guilty plea should have been withdrawn.
You know, all of Mr. Do I pronounce it correctly? Is it Mr. Schoberg?
That's correct, John.
All three of those things seem to be directly contradicted by the transcript. I mean, you know, is anyone pressuring you? No. You know, there's the discussion of what medication he's on, and you know this, and the court's, you know, and his admission that no, you know, that does not clouding my judgment, and then you know, as to the innocence, you know, I mean, the court goes in. You know, when the district court asked if it made sense, the court wouldn't let someone plead guilty who then says, I'm innocent, I didn't do it. And if it was right that the judge needed to convince people are actually guilty of these serious offenses before he let him go through probation. I mean, it seems to me, you know, that questioning would have triggered, well, wait a minute, you know, I didn't do it. And that didn't happen.
Sure. And I think Mr. Haig had the best argument when addressing this at the district court level in that, yes, he answered all the questions correctly. They went through the plea petition. He followed the prompts.
Well, I mean, you know, and that colloquy, though, is not, that wasn't quite the leading questions from the court. I mean, that was more of an open-ended, I mean, I saw that colloquy as more, okay, do you get it? As opposed to now just going through the leading questions that we all know we go through to get a yes answer on the record.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think when you look at both Mr. Haig's and the appellant's affidavit, he has been conditioned over many years to kind of follow directions of anybody in a supervisory role. Specifically, he was going to be in a position to answer those questions yes or no, to provide the answers that were expected of him under those circumstances. And specifically, we look at the medication questions, and some of those questions, Mr. Haig appropriately identified that he didn't, in fact, acknowledge all the different medications he was on before the court. So there was some lapses in a couple of those different areas where he simply answered, yes, this is the medication I'm on. He didn't expand upon any of the additional medications.
Well, I mean, he said, you know, it helps me, on the question of medication, it helps me calm down and think clearly, calm things down a bit. So, I mean, that colloquy would suggest he understands the court's question, which is, so is this, you know, are you of sound mind, you know, or, and his answer is, yes, this is what the, you know, the medication is not impairing my ability to think clearly. Here's what the medication does. I mean, that, I mean, I find that very telling as to, at least to the medication issue, as to whether he was cognizant of pleading guilty or not. I mean, it sounds like, no, 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 don't worry about the medication. It doesn't stop me from thinking clearly. Actually, it helps me think clearly. I mean, that, I don't think that helps you at all, Mr. Schoenberg.
Sure, and I would just assert that, yes, he has the ability to answer some simple questions. He has the, and he has some, my argument isn't that he has no cognitive ability. And that wasn't the argument placed before the court. The issue was, and that's in particular why this was not really argued as part of a manifest injustice standard, that his plea was somehow inaccurate or inappropriately given. Instead, this was briefed and argued more along the lines of the of 1505 subdivision 2, which is the unfair or fair and just, as weighed against the prejudice to the state.
On the issue of coercion, which is one of the arguments made, although I appreciate that you're making it in the fair and just context, I mean, you would agree with me, this was in a situation where he had not had enough time to meet with his lawyer. I mean, this case had been pending about 7 months at the time he entered his guilty plea.
I mean, correct.
It wasn't like it was his first appearance and he's pleading guilty before he's really had a chance to process the claims against him.
Correct. Although I would say that one of the very notable occurrences here is actually the judge's decision on the Spriegel, prior Spriegel offense coming in. So yes, he had been, to all the record indicates, involved with the case. I think it was both his counsel and Ms. Verdeja.
Well, I mean, I would think the Spriegels, I mean, that's what triggered the plea. You know, once he realized, whoops, this is coming in, this is not going to help me, I guess I better plead guilty now rather than going to trial and have that come in. I mean, that seems to be the informed decision processing that made him think, boy, you know, better plead guilty now as opposed to having this come in.
Sure, Your Honor. And I would argue just the opposite, because the it's a strange argument to make, but in this particular case, his plea, while it was to a lesser charge, basically was the equivalence of a plea to the original offense. The record also indicates that they were...
Would a plea to the original offense with his criminal history score result in a presumptive commit?
No.
Okay.
No, and that's actually reflected, I believe, in the record also. The only difference between the two, it was that he would have had 36 months hanging over his head as compared to the 18 months hanging over his head. That is the only difference between what he was charged with and ultimately what he pled to. So what we have is a morning where the Spriegel decision is made. It's,
well, if your probation is revoked, going to prison for 18 months is certainly better than going to prison for double that amount.
Correct. But it's a presumptive stay in either situation.
Okay, fair enough.
So turning attention to the last factor is the prejudice to the state. In this particular case, I think this is another compelling reason why the judge's decision should be reversed. In particular, Ms. Verdeja, didn't set forth any compelling reasons why this would prejudice the state. She doesn't argue that they would have difficulty presenting their case, that the witnesses' recollection would be somehow adversely affected. Her argument is essentially that this would be hard on them. That's a fairness argument, not a prejudice argument.
Well, but isn't the inference from the argument that we may have difficulty securing the witnesses' cooperation? I mean, particularly with the Spriegel witness, who I believe is a niece of the defendant's and had been abused 10 years earlier or 8 years earlier or whatever it was at the time. I mean, isn't that a legitimate inference for a district court to draw from the state's note that, you know, that this would be hard on witnesses?
And I would argue, if you review it, that decision I don't believe was even made till the previous day, so their preparation of this witness didn't even begin until that morning. So I'd argue that any prejudice would be overweighed by their ability to prepare this witness and take
more
time.
Well, but I mean, we had 6 months between when the guilty plea was entered and this case came back for sentencing and the motion to withdraw the plea was made. So, I mean, that victim wasn't in the courtroom. The Spriegel victim wasn't in the courtroom on the day he brought his motion to withdraw the plea.
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah. See that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
You will have 5 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Schoberg. We will hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, representing the state in this matter. Issue before this court today is not to reevaluate whether there were compelling reasons below and to weigh those reasons or to make credibility determinations. As this court has already noted, we are here under the narrow question of did the district court abuse its discretion in giving due consideration to the factors offered in favor of withdrawing the plea and balancing those against the prejudice that granting that motion would pose to the state and to the victims.
What evidence did the state submit to the district court in opposition to this motion of any prejudice?
No documentary or testimonial evidence, Your Honor. There was argument at the sentencing record. That's found on transcript pages 21 through 26 of the sentencing transcript. And specifically to the previous point made about they didn't argue whether there was prejudice to the state, if Your Honors look at that transcript, they do. The state stated very specifically and pretty persuasively that we have two sexual assault victims in this case, one of whom is the niece and one is an adult, and there were serious concerns about what bringing those two victims back in 6 months later would have on both their testimony and just quite frankly on the victims themselves. And so that was raised below and argued.
And do I pronounce correctly? Is it Mr. Yount?
Yes.
You know, I certainly sympathize with the idea of telling an 11-year-old that it's over and then 5 months later saying we're going to trial. However, I think the case law does not support that. I mean, simply because the victim now has to testify at trial is not prejudice, even if it is an 11-year-old, and whether that's, you know, I can certainly appreciate, you know, the difference between the real world and appellate land, where we all are, but that is what the appellate cases say. So the fact that the 11-year-old had to go to trial, I don't think that's enough for prejudice to the state. It would have to be more along the lines, as Judge Bjorkman has ably pointed out, well, the victim's gone, you know, documents have been lost, you know, yet-da-da-da-da. So simply, am I incorrect in saying simply requiring either an adult or a victim to testify at trial is not sufficient prejudice to the state?
I would direct Your Honor to the state or to the decision Kim v. State, Supreme Court decision out of 1989. It in fact involved a CSC charge, and there specifically the court noted in its balancing of the factors in prejudice to the state, it noted that there were 26 witnesses that the state was going to cause, and that it also specifically stated that it's appropriate and proper to consider the impact that it would have for the victims in that case. And so relying on that, it is appropriate for the district court to take that into consideration here.
And is that cited in your brief?
It's the Kim v. State decision, yes, Your Honor.
Kim v., K-I-M-V-I-E?
I'm sorry.
Oh, Kim v. State.
Versus
I'm sorry.
State.
Yes, I do see it. Thank you very much.
Yes. And I suppose while I bring that up, we should linger here to clarify something that opposing counsel brought up in oral argument. He cited the Williams case from 1985. And the reason why he cited that case is because there's language in that Williams decision talking about how these types of motions should be leniently granted. This court has had a number of cases after the fact recognizing that that Kim versus State decision essentially moved away from the Williams leniency standard. And this may not be cited in the briefs, but after I found out that we had our panel, there was a decision in 2012 that can be found at 2012 WL118238. That's from Your Honor, Honorable Bjorkman, who were presiding at the time. It's unpublished and, of course, not persuasive, but it does show that that's the direction this court has accepted, is that we've moved away from that leniency standard. And the reason is because we need it to be a fair and just standard, not a lenient standard. And again, focusing on what the standard before the court is today, it's did the district court abuse its discretion in balancing the factors in favor and against? And the, you know, to Your Honor's point about the victims, that was the primary motivating factor before the judge below about why he denied this motion. In 1997, appellant sexually molested a teenage girl who was sleeping over at his house, and he pled guilty to fourth-degree CSC. 20 years later, appellant sexually molested a teenage girl sleeping over at his house, and he was charged with second- and fourth-degree CSC. These are two victims, one of whom was in high school at the time that this case was going on below, and both of them did come forward and were willing to confront their abuser in open court. They weren't willing to. It was tough, but they were willing to. But on October 16, 2017, when appellant entered his plea of guilty, those two victims were told, you no longer have to do that. And in accordance with the Kim versus State decision, that's a relevant factor to consider. And coupled with the timeliness factor here, we have a six-month period after those victims were allowed to continue to go on with their life, after one of whom was in high school talking to her counselor, having to deal with her peers and what they thought about her, trying to move on with her high school teenagehood, to haul her back into court. That was the primary motivating factor in the district court's decision. And case law makes it clear that that's an appropriate consideration.
Was the district court aware at the time of the motion of, I think the answer is yes, of the fact that the victim of the charged offense tried to persuade the defendant's own daughter to level a similar charge that the county then did charge and then ultimately dismissed as not being verified? I mean, was the district court aware of that?
The district court was aware that the charges had been brought against him because it related to whether, I believe, the initial time that he was held in jail, so that was part of the record, why he was, and I know that's in the transcripts. I don't know about the specifics. This is mentioned in the transcript. There were a lot of negotiations off the record that at the court, and quite frankly, the appellant was very involved with.
But doesn't that conduct by the victim, the second victim, I mean, support the actual innocence assertion that the defendant made in support of his motion? And isn't that something that should be concerning to the state and everyone?
Sure, and let me respond to that question in 2 points, Your Honor. First of all, at this stage, we're not here to weigh the credibility of the victims. That's already been done by the district court. We're here to decide if the district court abused its discretion in giving that due consideration. But perhaps more to Your Honor's point, at every stage on October 16th, on October 30th during the psychosexual evaluation, on December 19th during the PSI report, appellant himself maintained that he had committed the criminal sexual conduct at issue. He pled guilty, and I believe, as Your Honor pointed out in the transcript, described in his own words the conduct that he did and that he himself admitted to doing to the teenage girl. At every stage of the way, he himself maintained that he had committed what he had done. Now, he had hesitations about what it meant and, you know, whether he intended to do it, and that's fine, but that also shows that there's a guilt element, that he was aware of what he had done and how tragic it could have been. And so, to Your Honor's point about whether we should be concerned with the innocence, for 4 months before he brought his motion to withdraw his plea, appellant wasn't concerned about his innocence. He had pled guilty to the crime. And then, the final point that I wanted to talk about today is that Your Honor was asking about how the testimony transcript directly contradicts these post-plea claims of innocence or ineffective counsel or that he misunderstood. And the governing case that shows how courts deal with that is the Abdi Salon case that's cited throughout my brief. And there you routinely see that courts, both the district court and the court of appeals, look to the objective record to see if it supports the district court's decision and how it exercised its discretion. And this record shows that appellant did not maintain his innocence. He was offered numerous times the ability to say, whoa, 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 slow down. Whoa, I'm not sure. He had able-bodied counsel who was experienced. And in fact, a very telling part of the colloquy is the court says, you've actually been more involved than the typical defendant in these plea negotiations. You've been here watching how this goes. And appellant agrees, saying, yes, I have, Your Honor. That directly contradicts, as I think as Your Honor put it, the second, secondhand thought, or maybe trying to take it back. He pled guilty knowingly, voluntarily, accurately, and the record shows that almost unquestionably. And then I think for the final remark is just to clean up something that was asked on appellant's oral argument is the significant cognitive limitations. This is not a man who had a Rule 20, as it was brought up before. He had previous, you know, he had done almost exactly the same previous thing, had gone through the same exact horse and pony show. I mean, this is a man who held a job continuously, was gainfully employed. In fact, according to his PSI, he ran his own business. He had multiple jobs. He lived a life. He was not, there's nothing in the record, no expert testimony, nothing showing that he was so cognitively unable to understand what was going on. And coupled with the objective testimony of him on the record, on five or six occasions, as cited in my brief, stating that I understand what's going on, what I'm doing, what I'm waiving during his plea colloquy, this record supports the district court's discounting of his newly found claims of innocence or misunderstanding or of ineffective counsel. And so unless your honors have any other further questions, we would just ask that this court affirm the district court's decision in denying the motion to withdraw the plea.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Schoberg, you'll have the last word, sir.
I just wanted to hit upon a couple things. Specifically regarding the delay, we addressed that previously. I would indicate that his assertion of innocence, and I would dispute counsel's assertion that at no point did he assert his innocence after that October 16th plea hearing. I would certainly point to the pre-sentence investigation and indicate that he, in fact, his version of events were contrary, were different than what he described in the actual plea hearing. And that his version of offense as presented to the pre-sentence investigator was asserting his innocence. So while there was a delay between the plea hearing and his actual withdrawal or his motion hearing to withdraw his guilty plea, we see some of his innocence or his assertion of innocence occurring well before that. Additionally, it was asserted, well, in this particular case, there was no Rule 20. There was never an assertion that his cognitive abilities rose to such a level that he could not be held criminally liable for his actions or alleged actions. But there is a vast difference between being incapable of standing trial pursuant to Rule 20 and the cognitive disabilities that this individual has. And I think that is a very compelling difference, and there's a substantial difference between that very high threshold and what we're dealing with in this particular case. I would also talk as far as the delay is concerned. Some of this delay was caused by the transfer of new counsel. It does appear that the plea hearing itself was set out, or I'm sorry, the sentencing hearing was set out for some lengthy period of time away from the actual plea hearing itself. I believe it was set approximately 3-4 months out. It was continued, I believe, once due to unavailability of the new counsel. And finally, we talk about the due consideration by the courts that was argued, and I would agree that it's a question of whether the district court gave proper consideration or due consideration to this balancing of what's just and fair as compared to the prejudice to the state. The only findings that the district court judge made was that, yes, this would be hard. It'd be hard on these people, be hard on these individuals. We want some finality here. And I would argue that those limited findings that he made did not rise to a balancing of both these just and fair elements that the defendant or appellant presented and the lack of prejudice that the state failed to assess or assert in their arguments. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll rest.
I had just one, Mr. Schoberg. Do you agree that Kim does stand for the proposition that among the issues of considering prejudice to the state is the impact on having the victim testify at trial now?
You know, I thought I was just reading that case prior to coming in here today, and I don't recall that being the basis for it. So without being able to review it again, Your Honor, I don't think I'm in a very good position to argue one way or another.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schoberg.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The matter is submitted.